What's it like walking around when you know that there's a sniper on the battlefield that can hit a moving target at distance?
I have never felt more alive than that deployment. Like, I don't think people really understand that. And so it's terrifying but thrilling at the same time.
Yeah.
And I used to, when we would get down on boardwalk, like the main road, and you knew it was coming because we'd go down Haditha Road and turn on boardwalk or Market Road or whatever it was, right along the, like, there's the main road and the Euphrates River and stuff. And when we rounded the corner, all the merchants are closing up shop. They're shutting their doors and everything. And you just know it's coming.
Yep.
And you don't know where it's coming from.
These are stories of outdoor adventure and expert advice from folks with calloused hands. I'm James Nash, and this is the Six Ranch Podcast. Like ranchers throughout the West, I'm spending the spring building fence. And it is an arduous task. The wire's heavy, the posts are heavy, the ground is rocky. You just break yourself into pieces. So to kind of psych myself up for the day, I pour a cup of coffee into a Stanley mug. I like the titanium series the best. And then I go out and I hammer posts into rocky ground. I stretch the wire. I get cut. You know, I try not to swear too much and I work all day long. And at the end of the day, I'm going to pour myself a cold drink into one of the coolest products that they make, which is the Lifted Spirits Prismatic Rocks glass. When you pour your whiskey over rocks into a glass, the ice melts pretty quickly, it seems like. So having that insulation makes for a better drink, in my opinion. And then these things have a prismatic cut in the stainless steel at the bottom that is also really pretty to look at. And I think that that's part of the experience of enjoying an ice glass of whiskey. So there's two times during almost every day that I'm using something from this, you know, great American company that's been around since 1913. They've got all kinds of gear on their website, and you can save yourself some money by using the discount code 6RANCH. That's the number 6 and the word ranch. It gets you 25% off. And then there's a 6RANCH Outfitters collection on their page. There's a link to that in this podcast description. And that will take you right to a page that has all of the things that I like to use. Now, I don't make any money off this. It's not how most discount codes work. This is just a savings that I'm passing along to you. Stanley has been a sponsor of this show for years now. They've been so supportive. And if it weren't for that support, I wouldn't be able to continue doing this. So you can support the show and get a good piece of gear at a discount by using this discount code and buying something that you like or something that you think somebody else would like. So you can go to Stanley1913.com, collections, 6RANCH Outfitters, or you can look at anything else on the website, but use that discount code and save yourself a couple bucks.
But yeah, he dropped that saddle and stuff and, you know, out of the back of his flatbed going up the road, and he came all the way back down for it and stuff, but yeah.
Were they archery hunting?
Mm-hmm.
So it was just a riding saddle that bounced out of a pickup or something?
Yeah.
Did it get run over?
No.
Oh, that's
no.
good.
No. Yeah, I mean, I would hope somebody wouldn't run it over.
Well, what happens sometimes is, you know, guys have it in the back of their truck, but they're pulling a trailer. So as soon as it bounces out, the trailer's coming right over the top of it.
Yeah. But no, it didn't look like it.
Broken saddle tree, and you don't know it until you get on your horse, and all of a sudden it's like, this is a little sloppy.
Yeah.
So you've been bear hunting this spring a little bit?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I did a trade at work to get 6 days straight, and then my buddy, he brought his trailer over for like the first four, and then he had to go home, and I'm like, well, I still got 2 days left, and so I got to be back at work tomorrow, and so I was like, I'm just going to come back over. I'm going to give her hell. And cause there's a way to get all the way to the bottom of Joseph Canyon from his property there on a BLM road. And I went all the way down to the bottom and didn't wear any sunscreen. Went all the way down the bottom and was glassing and looking and stuff. And it's the first time I've had a bear tag.
Yeah.
So, I mean, outside of fall bear, but spring bear. And so I was like really after it and I just didn't see a single bear. I saw a deer yesterday. Mm. I saw a buck. He's barely coming out.
Isn't it wild that there aren't more deer in all that habitat?
It is.
Yeah.
It is. But it makes sense. Like listening to the stuff that you talk about and how explaining the decline in the mule deer and stuff. I mean, I think it was a mule deer. I couldn't really tell because it was kind of bedded down and stuff. Mm-hmm. I mean, his antlers were going out like it was a mule deer maybe, but I don't know. I saw tons of whitetails running around.
Yeah.
But
yeah. Yeah, the whitetail are going into a lot of country that they're not used to. And I've been trying to get to the bottom of whether whitetail are native here or not. There's an article written in one of the Le Grand newspapers that had quotes from an old school wildlife biologist. And he said that I want to say 1940, there was an attempt to reintroduce whitetail to the northern Wanaha on the Washington side. Mm-hmm. So the Washington Department of Fish and Game kicked some deer loose up there. And that there were no whitetail here prior to that, but he said that they were here prior to 1890. And then they evaporated, like whatever, got shot out. Who knows? But I can't find any evidence that they were here prior to 1890. Mm-hmm. So I'm really curious about that. You know, are all of these whitetail just a product of that reintroduction just over the state line? Mm. I don't know. But now they're showing up deep in the canyons, higher and higher in the mountains. It's interesting. And they're not well suited for that steep country. They do good in the brushy stuff in the valleys and ag fields. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it's interesting.
Yeah. Well, I know that even in Washington, there's a decline over there too.
For sure.
Because, gosh, when I got out in 2009 and I went and my brother-in-law lived in Vancouver at the time and they were always going to the Duquesne area over there deer hunting and they were killing huge bucks.
Yeah.
I mean, it was not uncommon to pull a couple of 180s out of there.
Really?
And so they were, so there's the last resort in the Duquesne River and stuff. And we'd go all the way up top and we'd hunt the canyons where there was the schoolhouse fire in like 2005, I think. And they had find these huge sheds, at least one bear would get killed and everyone would fill their deer tags on big bucks. And so, and it was like, it was when I was finally getting back into hunting and because I was finally back home and I wasn't like, because I didn't get to hunt really at all when I was in Hawaii in the Marine Corps.
Right.
But, and so it was worth it to go all the way up there and stuff. And since then, like once we decided that we're moving to Pendleton, I was like, this is awesome because now I'm like, an hour and a half, hour and 45 minutes away from there. And so the first year I came up and they make it, it's a 3-porter bender unit. And the first year I came up, all I saw was fork and horns. Mm. Then the next year I didn't see a buck. Mm. And then the next year I did it, I didn't even see a mule deer at all. Right. And now last year after I came back from Idaho, I went up there cause I can get the veteran rate for the license and stuff up there. And I know there's an elk herd on one of the ridges in there. And I was like, I'm going to go see if there's a spike in that herd. And so I went up there last year after it was like early October and I didn't see anything, nothing, not even a deer. And it was like the metropolis of deer hunting. And now it's just terrible.
Yeah.
It's absolutely terrible. And the only thing I like driving the roads up there, all I saw whitetails.
Yeah, it's interesting. It's really interesting. And it's complicated. Like, you can't just be like, oh, it's just lions. Or, you know, we've got too many bears. People will throw migration corridors out there. You know, that's a big one now. It's like, have we really changed, like, road infrastructure and added fences? Winter grounds? No, that's hasn't really changed. So I don't think we can really put our finger on, you know, even the biggest part of the problem right now, because mm-hmm. there's just lots of little parts of the problem.
Yeah.
It is very complicated and very interesting. And I hope that biologists start taking it more seriously and frankly feeling some shame around it. You know, if I was a wildlife biologist and I had a species that was just plummeting in population like this, and I wasn't figuring out what the problem was and developing solutions, I would feel ashamed.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Because it's pretty terrible.
It is. It's sad.
Well, like, and you said, yeah. What was it? Last year, you had the points to draw some deer tag in Oregon, and you're like, I'm not even going to do it.
Right. Like, that was 12 preference points. That was 12 years of my life mm-hmm. that I had applied to get a deer tag. And when I finally drew it, based on the aerial surveys that were going on and people that were flying it a lot who are really good at flying for wildlife, they said, look, you know, we're just up for 6 hours. We saw four deer. Like, one of them's a buck, but like, that's it. Like, they weren't in the ag fields. Mm-hmm. They weren't in the sage. I was like, I can't, and I'm not saying that there's only four deer in the unit. I'm not saying that at all.
Mm-hmm.
What I am saying is that these guys had flown that area for 20 years and flown it specifically for wildlife, and they knew how to find animals and they knew the region. If they weren't seeing 100 deer in a flight like that, then there's a significant problem. So I just couldn't contribute to that. I mm-hmm. couldn't morally contribute to further decline in that population just to satiate, you know, my desire to make right on 12 years of applications.
Like, mm-hmm.
It's just, I couldn't eat that animal and feel good about the meal.
Mm-hmm.
I couldn't look at antlers on a wall and feel good about that experience. That's taking too much.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess I just fell on my sword on that one.
Yeah. Well, if you get a few more points, go down to Southern Oregon.
Yeah.
Do the, it's a muzzleloader rut tag for blacktail.
Mm.
I know some good spots down in there.
Okay.
But
I've never killed a blacktail.
You haven't?
No.
Oh, that's all I grew up doing.
Yeah.
Like, yeah. We'd go into the Keno and stuff and sit in tree stands, like, cause it's so dry mm-hmm. archery hunting. We just sit in tree stands and shoot them out of tree stands and stuff. And then like down around Medford area and stuff. And that's all we did.
Yeah.
Just hunt around the poison oak and shoot blacktails covered in poison. Oh, dude, it sucked.
I never thought about that, getting all the poison on you just from gutting the deer.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, that cow that I killed over in Idaho last year, I was closer to the river than I was to the top of the canyon where I came up and over.
Right.
And I cut it all. Man, dude, I got a Benchmade knife and I'm never going to look back.
Yeah.
That thing was amazing.
Which one?
It's the Hidden Canyon Hunter.
That's a good knife.
Dude. Well, I paid attention to what a lot of people were saying about certain knives and this and that. And I was like, I don't need a huge knife.
Yeah.
And I did that whole cow, like 80% of it with that. I'm using up my, those razor blade knives. I hate those things.
Outdoor Edge or,
I have one of those, but it's something else. But basically the whole, and I wasn't being nice with it.
Right.
Like, I was going through the hide and everything and it just wouldn't stop. It wouldn't get dull, but I got it all done and I hauled a quarter out that one day and I called my friend and I was like, and he's like, he works in Ontario, but he lives in Idaho.
Yeah.
And he's like, I was like, hey, I got one. And he's like, well, send me a pin. And he's like, oh man, dude. And he told me, he's like, I'll come up.
Yeah.
And so we hauled a quarter out and then he came up in the morning, went up and over and he took a rear and I took both rear fronts or something like that. Hauled it all out in the second trip. But the next, like 2 days later or so when I got home, I had poison oak all over my, or poison ivy.
I don't know the difference. I think it's poison oak around here.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. But no, blacktail, why do you think that there's this? You're the good person to ask about this.
Oh God.
Is why are mule deer declining and blacktails not? Cause I mean, they're thriving down in Southern Oregon.
Yeah. It's a really good question. You know, mule deer have been declining throughout their range since 1959, more or less. Like, if you were to pick the peak population of mule deer as a species, it would be 1959.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that there is a combination of factors that allowed them to get that high of a population. A lot of it being being sheep herders out on the range.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, as sheep really started to come off the range, then we started to see a lot more decline in mule deer. There has been an increase in elk numbers,
mm-hmm.
and elk eat a lot of the same stuff as muleys. So some numbers I've heard is that one elk equals 6 mule deer as far as how much of the niche they take up mm-hmm. in the ecosystem. So if you have, you know, an elk herd that goes from 100 to 600, like now that's, what, 3,600 mm-hmm. deer that don't get to be there?
Mm-hmm.
You know, it turns into a really rapid thing. I don't know a lot about blacktail, and I get confused about, like, where a blacktail becomes a mule deer. And any book that you read tends to treat them similarly. Like, the scientific literature I have will be, like, mule and blacktail deer of North America. And
they don't look anything alike.
Right, but then you get regions like the Cascades where it's like, okay, are you a mm-hmm. blacktail now? Or are you a mule deer now? They can interbreed.
Bench legs. That's what some people call them, and I don't know if anybody's actually proven that a bench leg actually exists.
Right.
Because, like, they're in Keno where we're hunting. Between Keno and Klamath Falls, like, you know, Klamath Falls, you're going to get the mule deer, but over in Keno, it's like, but we shot some deer that were pretty big, but their racks were blacktails, and so, but yeah, I don't know.
Yeah. I was at a buddy's ranch in Scott Valley in California, and I said, well, what kind of deer do you have here? And he said, well, we've got blacktail and mule deer. It's like, really? Like, together? And he's like, well, no. See that creek down there? Little creek. Like, I could almost jump across it, kind of creek.
Mm-hmm.
And there are some deer that were crossing it right now. He said, right now, those are mule deer. But as soon as they cross the creek, they're blacktail. And we do the same thing with Roosevelt elk in Oregon, right? So if they're west of I-5, mm-hmm. they're a Roosevelt. If they're east of I-5, then they're a Rocky.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that's bonkers. That is not good science.
No.
It's asinine.
No.
And to further complicate that one, up until 1938... we moved a bunch of Rocky Mountain elk into Western Oregon to boost those Roosevelt populations.
Mm-hmm.
So when we're talking about like a genetic difference, like a subspecies, and then you just put a bunch of Rockies over there to mm-hmm. boost them up again, it's like, is there really a difference between a Roosevelt and a Rocky?
I'm not intelligent enough to answer that.
It's tough.
Mm-hmm.
And start digging into websites and stuff like that, and they'll be like, well, Roosevelts tend to have a lighter body color or a darker body color or palmated antlers or, you know, body size, but they don't have numbers on any of it.
Mm-hmm.
And you take a herd of Rockies out here and you'll see every kind of color that an elk can throw.
Yeah.
It just gets weird. I know the state has had a hard time, getting back to your question, I know the state has had a hard time actually surveying blacktail for a long time, because throughout a lot of their range, they are in jungle and they're fairly nocturnal. So how do you count that animal?
Mm-hmm.
And one of the best mechanisms they have is road kills.
Really?
Yeah.
I thought it would be like game cameras or something like that would be their option.
Game cameras are tough because how do you know you're seeing a different individual?
Mm-hmm.
That's why they're struggling with wolf counts on the west side, too.
Mm-hmm.
Wolves are the only animal in Oregon that they count every single individual to create their population. And they need to know that that's not an individual that they previously counted. And that's all fine and dandy on the east side, where we're not completely covered in trees and you can fly and use radio telemetry and stuff like that. As soon as you have a solid canopy on the west side, how do you count those wolves anymore?
Yeah.
Not like that.
Yeah.
You know, then you have to start using population models, and that hasn't happened yet.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah. How good do blacktail taste?
I think they taste better than mule deer.
Yeah.
I've
heard that from everyone.
Yeah. I think they taste better than mule deer, but also that's just like what their diet is.
Because. Yeah.
Mule deer, I mean, they eat a lot of sage and this and that, but they're still kind of gamey. But I mean, man, I shot so many blacktails out of tree stands and stuff, and I used to shoot spikes like crazy out of the tree stands, but they're pretty good.
Yeah.
They're pretty good.
Yeah. What were they eating over there?
Just forbs or grass and just.
Are there any nuts? Are there acorns or anything like that?
Around Jacksonville, I guess there are.
Yeah.
Like south of Medford and stuff in there, but.
There's a lot of orchards.
Mm-hmm. Well, not anymore.
Oh, really?
They're all hemp fields now.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah.
No kidding.
Yeah. The drive from, might go down Jacksonville Highway to Jacksonville and like to the baseball fields, they used to be strawberry patch orchards or pears. Like that was Harry and David down there and stuff. And now they're all hemp fields.
Interesting.
Yeah, they've torn it because they used to be, Medford used to be the pear capital of the world, growing them there.
Uh-huh.
And they've been ripping them all out and putting hemp fields in.
And is it hemp for like cordage and fiber, or is it like THC?
Yeah. No, well, it does. There's like such a low amount of THC in it. Like it's a little like CBD too. Like people,
right.
I think actually miners can buy CBD because there's like nothing in it that's. There's nothing advertised in it, but when I went through the drug recognition expert school and the instructors that were talking to us, they said all like the CBD, like this and that, all the things that you can buy, it's not really regulated that much. Right. And when it's been tested, there's actually decent amounts of THC found in some of it.
Mm.
And so it's not as safe as some people say, but I haven't seen any of that.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. And how would you, I don't know. I don't know enough about it. Don't know a lot about drugs.
I know a decent amount.
I bet you do now.
Yeah.
Let's dial it back a little bit. Why and when did you decide to join the Marine Corps?
That's a good question. Well, when I was going into my senior year and stuff and like graduating, I was like, I'm not going to go to college. Like I was like, I'm never going to go to college. And I was like, well, I don't want to stay here. And so I was like, but I knew I wanted, and this is what I tell people all the time. It's like, I wanted to be a part of something bigger than myself. I was like, what better than to join the Marine Corps infantry and go, and, 'cause honestly, I just wanted to go see combat.
And were you like 17 years old at the time?
Mm-mm. No, I graduated and I was 18, and then I was 19 later that summer.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. I showed up to boot camp on the Marine Corps birthday, and I didn't know it was the Marine Corps birthday.
Oh God.
And they were serving lobster and all this stuff. I'm like, this is what they serve at boot camp? This is amazing. And then I realized what it was. Yeah.
Well, that's nice.
Yeah.
That's an easy entry.
Yeah.
So did you get to pick infantry with your like recruitment package or whatever?
They basically said I could be a cook, motor T, or infantry, but I specifically chose it.
Okay.
Because I don't know. I think of like when people think of like the Marine Corps infantry or the Marine Corps, you think of infantry and this and that. And I specifically chose it. And my mom was just like, oh my gosh, what are you doing? Like there's two wars going on right now. And so.
So what year was this?
05.
05. Okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yep. 2005.
Yeah. Yeah. So Ramadi had just been super hot.
Mm-hmm.
You know, incredible amounts of uncertainty in the Iraqi campaign for sure.
Mm-hmm.
Afghanistan was happening, but we didn't really know what was going on. It was a little bit backburnered in 05.
Mm-hmm. It was still going.
Oh, it was mm-hmm. going, but everybody's focus in the media
was
Iraq for sure, yeah. Right? Okay, so how was boot camp? What did you learn about yourself?
I don't think I learned anything. I thought it was pretty easy.
Yeah.
To be honest, it was just kind of annoying with certain stuff. And I wasn't like a standout, but I wasn't like the slug. I was just kind of like there and I just did everything and I did well. And
dude, that's the place to be.
Yeah.
That's the place to be. Like you want to be the best at something. You don't want to be the worst at anything. Most of the time, stay in the middle of the pack. Like that's how to do boot camp or officer candidate school for that matter. Yeah.
Yeah.
Be the gray man.
No, boot camp wasn't bad. And then And then we had like 10 days leave, came back down to San Diego, went to SOI. And then, oh man, I was fully planning on being at 29 Palms or Camp Pendleton. Mm-hmm. And I can't remember whether it was like maybe 200 or 300 of us in our school inventory class. I can't remember how many, but, and so when they came out with all the orders and they're like, hey, 13 of you are going to Hawaii. I'm like, man, that would suck to be that guy. Cause I didn't want to, I wanted to stay on the West Coast.
Right.
And 13 of us, including me, are going to Hawaii. And I'm like, gosh, freaking dang it, dude. And so we went to K Bay, mm-hmm. and we showed up and they were halfway through their workup for the first deployment to Iraq. Cause they just come back from Afghanistan.
So you're basically a fill-in at that point.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
Oh yeah. Like it was like 3.5-4 months of a workup. And then we left cause they had gotten back from Afghanistan. And so, yeah, it was quick. And so when I did that, we did another one. And then when we came back, me, myself and 12 other guys got kind of screwed over because they said, hey, you have enough time to do a short-term third deployment. So do you want to extend? I'm like, no, I want to go to college. Mm. And they're like, well, you're going to go anyways and you might extend. I'm like, I'm not extending.
Right.
And so we went for 3.5-4 months to Afghanistan. So
where were you in Afghanistan?
Oh, gosh, dang it. It's somewhere near Nowzad.
Okay.
Somewhere near that. But we were on a huge base and stuff. And so when I told them I wasn't going to extend, so the first deployment was in Haditha,
okay.
06, 07. The second one was
Haditha Dam.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. And, well, we were south of the dam. We didn't get to stay at the dam. The dam was nice. But, no, we were in Haditha. Mm-hmm. And then the second one was we were operating out of Camp Fallujah. And that was after all the fighting was pretty much done there.
Yeah.
And then the third one was, yeah, somewhere near Nowzad. But I was on a huge base. And when I told them I wasn't going to extend, they took me out of the platoon that I was in. I started teaching, like, admin people how to stand post. And it was really bad.
Yeah, that sounds tough.
Yeah. There was a couple of wake-up calls for people and stuff like that because they're sleeping and stuff. And there was a MARSOC base inside our base, too. Like, they had their own little walled-out base there.
Where they can wear their pink underwear with each other and
yeah.
Whatever MARSOCers do.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's fun. Mm-hmm. I was going to say, you know, it can seem weird to civilians if vets can't remember important details like, you know, what base you were at and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. But it is really easy to forget very important things, especially if you mix in stuff like combat stress and brain injuries and stuff like that. Man, some of the stuff that is the very most important to you can be incredibly difficult to access and recall.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So what unit were you with?
2nd Battalion, 3rd Marines.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And is K Bay a nice base? Did you like living there, working there? Was it good training?
It was all right. I mean, they had a range there, but it was right along the beach, so it was really windy, and we rarely used it.
Mm.
We'd go over to Schofield Army Barracks across the island and use it.
Okay.
But, I don't know, after a couple of weeks, like, you kind of run out of stuff to do.
Yeah.
Almost. And we'd go down on the pier and go fishing for hammerhead sharks and until like 2 a.m. and stuff like that. But just kind of ran out of stuff to do and got kind of boring. But I mean, it was just like deployment workup. And so like, and we'd go train on the Big Island and stuff. So after the first deployment, I took the scout sniper indoc, passed it. And then I earned a spot in school, but I failed school because I wasn't sneaky enough.
I'm like, yeah.
I got busted so many times stalking.
Yeah.
And so, but I stayed in the platoon for that second deployment to Iraq. And then when I told them I wasn't going to extend, they told me, they're like, well, we're pulling you out of there and you're going to teach all the pokes how to stand post.
Yeah.
I was like, that's great.
What's a pogue?
Person other than grunt.
Okay. Yeah. So this is kind of a dig that Marines have against each other. What people need to understand about the Marine Corps, as opposed to other military branches, we're just about combat. Like, that's it. and the infantry is always the main effort, and every other aspect of the Marine Corps supports the infantry. Mm-hmm. And there's a ground combat element that includes, what is it, artillery, tanks, Amtraks, infantry, and combat engineers. Is that it? I think
yep,
there's five
pretty
much. Of them. So even, you know, me as a tanker, I'm still just a support element to the infantry, in theory. In practice, by the time I got to Afghanistan, President Obama had drawn us down so much that we only had enough infantry Marines to stock the bases. So there weren't enough infantry to go outside the wire. All you guys could do was like hold down the post and like try and keep these bases from getting overrun. So when I got there, it was us and recon, and we were the only maneuver elements in Helmand. And then recon got in trouble, as they do. Mm-hmm. And then it was just tanks. Mm-hmm. So we were the only maneuver element that the Marines had in Afghanistan.
Man.
Trying to do drug interdiction from tanks, like trying to search with tanks.
Oh,
like,
my gosh.
Everything's a hard knock.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like driving a motorhome to Coyote Campground. Jeez.
Yeah. Not too subtle.
Oh, man.
But no, it's interesting. Okay. So infantry mm-hmm. is the main effort. And I don't know. I think it's purely just misunderstanding why anybody would think that there's something negative about being in the infantry, in the Marines, because it's everything. It's everything to the entire branch. Like, and they're very much celebrated. We call them grunts. And if you're not a grunt, if you're not in the infantry, then you're a pogue. So technically I also am a pogue.
It's better than being a cook or admin or motor tea.
But we need them all, man.
Yeah,
we need them all. What are you going to do without food? What are mm-hmm. you going to do without trucks? Mm-hmm. Like, you just going to walk over there on an empty stomach?
Yeah.
Yeah. Huh. Did you have any rough deployments?
The first one was real bad.
What happened?
Oh, man. So we got to Haditha, I think it was October of 2006. And the battalion before us got pretty messed up mm-hmm. and they're like, hey, this is like a no shit like deployment. And so we show up and I think it was second day we got there. We went out on a patrol and one guy, we were walking down a road in an alleyway and a sniper tried to take a shot at him. I think it was before we actually had the side sappy plates. It was like the old flak jackets.
Right.
And
just the plate carriers,
mm-hmm.
right? Yeah.
And no, they weren't plate carriers. They were like, they looked like, I don't know.
They had so many different models mm-hmm. of those. It's hard to keep up.
Yeah. No, plate carriers. I didn't see plate carriers until the Afghanistan deployment.
Oh, really?
Yeah. But a sniper took a shot at one of the guys when we were, and I mean, people were covering the alley going, but he's in a window 150 yards away and you're not going to see him backed out into in a room.
No.
And it bounced off of the plate and the shrapnel is what hit his arm and it screwed up his arm and he couldn't even come back. But yeah, I mean, I achieved my goal. Like, got to see combat. Like
yeah.
It was pretty ruthless, and we'd get into a couple of firefights, like a couple of them every single patrol, and then they'd drop 40 or was it 80s, and into the base, shoot RPGs and like spray AKs a couple times a day, but
isn't it funny how quickly you can get used to indirect fire, just kind of around you, mm-hmm. and then if you hear AK fire, that's very different from when you hear just one shot,
mm-hmm.
like, you know, AK is like, oh, somebody's just like sticking their gun over a wall and yanking on the trigger. But if you hear just that one shot, it's like, oh, maybe somebody's got a decent rifle and knows what they're doing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What's it like walking around when you know that there's a sniper on the battlefield that can hit a moving target at distance?
I have never felt more alive than that deployment. Like, I don't think people really understand that. And so it's terrifying, but thrilling at the same time.
Yeah.
And I used to, when we would get down on Boardwalk, like the main road, and you knew it was coming because we'd go down Haditha Road and turn on Boardwalk or Market Road or whatever it was right along the, like there's the main road and the Euphrates River and stuff. And when we rounded the corner, all the merchants are closing up shop. They're shutting their doors and everything, and you just know it's coming.
Yeah,
and you don't know where it's coming from, but it's man, I don't think I've ever felt anything like that since then.
Yeah.
I don't think anything can ever match that.
Yeah,
because you know it's coming, and I used to do this like weird, like wiggle wobble, like what, like trying to be a hard target doing right. that.
Yeah, they called it like weebling or something, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Because I'm like, I am not getting hit by a sniper.
You can't do that in a tank. You just get shot.
No, no. But I mean, our lieutenant, he got shot in the face 100 yards away. We're in the Euphrates, in there, right there. He's like from me to you, right there. Just dropped, and he blinked, and he was dead. And since then, because he made it known he was a leader. Mm. He didn't wear anything like outside the wire, but. With the community leaders there, he made it known that he was a leader.
Mm.
And so he got picked off. And since then, our staff sergeant was like, we're not having any squad leaders or anybody leading, because he'd always be up front. He's like, and so for our squad, Scott Blanchard and myself, and they said, you guys are on point now. And I'm like, he just got shot in the face for being up front, and now we're going to be up front. And like, you want to talk about just increasing that anxiety.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was, but not the entire deployment. The entire deployment wasn't bad. Like after about 4 months, we just kicked the shit out of them and they just like pretty much stopped.
Yeah. And they kind of know the game at that point where, you know, they figured out that units are on a 6 month rotation or something like mm-hmm. that. And it's like, oh, you know, we pushed it too far. Now these guys are killing us back really hard. Let's just wait a few. Until the next unit comes in.
Mm-hmm. I think even after that, it was still, stayed pretty good.
Yeah. Good.
Yeah.
I know one of the dumb things that tankers do is they name their tanks, right?
Mm-hmm.
And they write the name of the tank on that bulge on the barrel. It's called an evacuator. It's what keeps smoke from rolling back inside the turret when you shoot the main gun.
Mm-hmm.
So every tank gets a name and, you know, we rolled in and, you know, the previous unit had named our tanks and we painted over the top of that and we renamed the tanks, which is a normal tradition to do. But even though, you know, the Taliban there, they can't probably read anything. They can see that the symbols are different mm-hmm. and they know that a different unit is rolled in. And, yeah, it's amazing. It's amazing how word travels around those elements or like from the enemy, like mm-hmm. when they know that an attack is about to happen and everything will look super normal. And then all of a sudden the kids disappear. It's like, all right, boys,
yep.
start paying attention.
Yep.
If you weren't already, like mm-hmm. it's about to happen.
Mm-hmm.
Kites were a really big deal where I was in Afghanistan. They communicated with kites a lot. So anytime we went on a patrol or something like that, kites would pop up and then you could see lines of kites going out for miles and miles.
Hmm.
So that's how they would communicate the position of my tank platoon.
Mm-hmm.
And you could always watch a line going to where we were. So anybody that could see the kites, all they had to do was be able to watch how they went out in a line and they knew that we were at the end of that.
Mm-hmm. Huh.
When you start listening to all the electronic communications, then they just stop using electronic communications and start using stuff that we can't easily track.
Kites.
Yeah.
Jeez.
So simple, right?
So smart.
So smart.
They're so smart.
Yeah. And tough.
Mm-hmm.
My God.
I don't think anybody's ever going to beat them in a war.
No. Well, I mean, one of the commanders of Afghan forces, when he was meeting with Alexander the Great, said, you can kill us, but you'll never deprive us of our poverty. Like, how do you fight a person like that?
Says that to you.
Like, you can't take anything from them.
Mm-mm.
Yeah. tough.
Yeah.
So you hunted before the Marines.
Mm-hmm.
And you hunted after the Marines.
Yep.
How bad did you want to start hunting again once you got out?
Was it
like a priority, or was it on the back burner?
It was a priority. Like, when I came back, I had 47 days of terminal leave. I had a whole pile of time off because we never took it.
Right.
It was just pre and post deployment. We'd get like a week and a half. And so I never took any time off or anything. And so I came back and I missed the fall semester at the community college. And so I had to start in the winter. And so I had time. And so I came up to Washington to hunt Duquesne area with my brother-in-law. And I asked him, I'm like, do I need my hunter safety ID card? Because I need to find that thing mm-hmm. for out of state, because I'd never hunted out of state before. And he's like, nope, 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 you're good. You do.
Yeah.
But once you get with them on file, they keep it on record. And so I was just kind of a packer that year and stuff. Yeah. And that's when I got to see it. But it was a priority, but it was different because my best friend and his dad, since I was gone, they transitioned from rifle to archery. Mm. And so I went out and bought a bow and I shot a lot of deer with that thing. And then once I moved up to Pendleton, it was 4 or 5 years ago, and I got that prime bow and at 80 pounds, and man, the thing's hammering.
They eat.
Oh man. Yeah. Oh, it's hammering.
Yeah. Good.
But yeah, it was, but.
Do you think it's important for your mental health?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, because more times when I go hunting, I don't actually kill something, mm-hmm. but just being up in like the Eagle Caps or Joseph Canyon or in Idaho too, because a lot of times I kind of prefer to hunt by myself.
Yeah.
It is fun to have some people come along, but it to slow everything down. It's something to, and it's also like every year, because I try to plan a couple of trips throughout the year, because it's something to look forward to just mellow out. And I find that when I come back from hunting, I'm more patient, I'm nicer, and yeah, I think so.
Good. What's a lesson that you learned in the Marines that you feel like improves your capability as a hunter?
Yes, and just never giving up.
Yeah.
Yeah. Or I'd say tougher than I actually think I am. Mm. And so.
Which is two sides of the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
But that persistence of, and it's not even an option. Mm-hmm. It's not like, oh, I decided not to give up. It's like, no, it's just. This is what you do.
Yeah.
This is how life is lived. You just don't give up.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think that's important. Preparation is a huge part of how you hunt. Like, you take your physical fitness extremely seriously. You're very studious. You do a lot of research. You ask people questions. You seek out experts. You do a lot of your work before you ever step out of the pickup. Mm-hmm. If you were to take one aspect of how you prepare and get rid of it, what would that be?
Oh, that's hard. One aspect.
And also, what would you do more of? Since you got rid of the one thing, now you've got some more time.
If I had to get rid of something, it would probably be scouting. And just get rid of that. And if I'm going to go to some new unit in Idaho and somebody said, you can't look at it, you just got to go. That's because everything else, like shooting, fitness and stuff like that, it's kind of important. Mm-hmm. And then what was the other thing?
What would you do more of now that you had extra time? The scouting is a big time tax.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I think what I would want to is I would want to dedicate more time to shooting my bow, but I would probably end up doing more working out.
Yeah.
Because elk are tough. They're tougher than us. So.
Yeah. They're really heavy. It's a problem.
And I don't like boning them out. I keep them on the quarters. So yeah. I've had friends and they're like, oh, let's just bone it out. I'm like, nope, it's staying on the quarters.
You know what is a power play with that that I should, I'll make a video of it this year so that people can understand better what I'm talking about. But we know about cutting off the hoof section, like the cannon bone section. Mm-hmm. There's absolutely zero meat on that. The bone's really dense, so there's just like a pencil width of marrow on the inside of it. There's no good reason to pack those things out. Mm-hmm. And they weigh 4 or 5 pounds a piece. Mm-hmm. So that next section up of bone that has the shank around it, you can easily cut that shank away from that section of bone and cut that bone off as well. And you're leaving the meat attached. Mm-hmm. Shank isn't particularly good meat in the first place. You know, you've basically got to braise it, grind it, you know, mm-hmm. do something pretty aggressive to make it edible. So you can lose a couple more pounds per quarter by knocking off that next section of bone without any significant loss to meat. Mm-hmm. And that's something that I'd like to see more people do. I do like to leave a bone in a quarter, that, you know, that humerus bone, that big heavy bone, mm-hmm. or femur, depending on what we're talking about. Scapula, I guess it would be on the front quarter. But keeping that bone in there, one, it keeps your meat a lot cleaner. You have a lot less surface area exposed to bacteria and dirt and all that crap. And then the rigidity you get out of keeping the bone in the middle, yes. makes it so much easier to pack out.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, and one thing you said a while back, I think it was you, said that made a lot of sense too, was if you leave it on the bone, or if you cut it off, you got to make another cut.
Yeah.
When you cut it, so you got to cut the crust off, so then you're actually losing meat,
right.
versus just leaving it on the bone, and you make that initial cut once you start cutting into it.
Yep. Yep. The more places that you cut it, the more you're going to have to cut again. Mm-hmm. You're just causing yourself work, and then you're losing meat as a mm-hmm. product of it. But man, if I'm super, super deep, and let's be honest and call that 2 miles. If I've got to pack an elk 2 miles, mm-hmm. the bones are coming out of it. I'm not packing an extra really? Ounce. Yes.
That's... My friends get real mad at me when I'm like,
hey, you can pack whatever you want. Yeah. I'm not going to cut it out of yours.
Yep.
But, you know, I've got to take care of my body so that I can keep doing this. And, you know, packing an extra 6 pounds a quarter, 8 pounds a quarter, not happening. Like I'm leaving that bone out there. What I will do is start a little fire if I can. If there's no crazy fire danger, I'll start a little fire. And one of the first things that I do is throw that femur on the fire. And then right before we start hiking, we break that thing open and eat all that hot bone marrow out of it. Mm-hmm. Oh, God. That is gourmet, buddy.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah.
I still have the femurs from my cow in Idaho.
Frozen?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I haven't cut them up yet.
You can just throw them on a barbecue. Mm-hmm. And when it starts to get a little bit charred looking on the outside, just crack it with the back of a hatchet and it'll come apart and... Mm-hmm. It's basically fat, but mm-hmm. if you put that over the top of meat, a little bit of salt, holy cow, that is so good.
Mm-hmm. I've had it before. Yeah. Oh, I've had beef.
Yeah.
Beef marrow, and it's like meat jelly.
Yeah. Yeah. Crossed with butter and yeah. awesomeness.
It is pretty good.
Yeah. It's awesome. You know, the earliest evidence of humans using knives predates our use of fire by over 1 million years. Hmm. And that evidence was on a femur bone of a zebra. Hmm. And you can see the marks under a
microscope.
Thank you. I posted a picture of it a long time ago. But they were trying to get at that bone marrow. You know, this is a big part of what it means to be a human and a hunter, is going after bone marrow. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I like it. I like it a lot. Yeah, man. So, hunting this fall.
Yep, just archery.
Yeah.
Yep.
Cool. See,
down in Ukiah there, because it's so close. I can get to my spot in like 45, 50 minutes or so. And I got the last 2 weeks of season carved out. I was just going to have the last week, but then somebody left, and so I was able to bump my vacation. So,
yeah.
And since they extended, they changed the dates for the season, it really worked out in my favor. And so...
I love how law enforcement is constantly just drug dealing days off so that people can do the stuff they want to do.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, it is straight up drug deals with trades and stuff with people. Oh, yeah. Yeah. Because it's nice when you get it,
yeah.
But then it sucks. It kind of sucks when you got to repay it.
Yeah.
But, I mean, it is what it is. And
I mean, you guys are helping each other. Mm-hmm. That's, you're especially in rural areas, you guys are by yourselves a lot.
Not us. I mean, out here, yeah, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I guess you're in a big unit, but you're broken apart and, mm-hmm. you know, you still need to find ways to support each other. That's, mm-hmm. that's what I'm getting at.
Yeah. Yeah. But so the day after Roundup ends, I'm gone for the last 2 weeks of the season. I'm just pumped.
Good.
I mean, I'll come back into town, you know, like not going to be like wife and daughter, are like see you in 2 weeks. So I'll be 45 minutes away. Like yeah. I'll come back a little bit and stuff, but
yeah,
no, it's going to be a good spot. That's where I killed that 4-point out of a couple of years ago. Mm-hmm. And then we got into them and stuff last year, a little bit early season, but man, oh man, it was just so hot. Like yesterday too, I just got roasted.
It's going to be interesting this year because nobody has hunted Oregon this week of the season ever. Like,
no.
For as long as we've had archery seasons, this last week of the season has been just a shut-off week before the rifle season start. And the game is changing sometimes by the hour at that stage of the season.
Mm-hmm.
So everybody's walking into this without the experience of, like, what elk do during that week here.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to be really interesting.
Mm-hmm.
People are, in my opinion, too excited about it. And it's going to have a lot of action. Mm-hmm. This is the James Nash prediction. There's going to be a lot of action that week. It's going to be a great auditory experience. But, man, it is hard to move bulls that week. It yeah. is really hard.
Yeah.
But if you get close to them, they're going to be chasing cows around, and you know you've just got to wait until a cow brings one over to you.
Mm-hmm.
But there's going to be a lot of guys just bugling their lungs out, and bulls bugling back, and dudes getting frustrated because nothing is happening.
No, because they already got their herds and everything. They're coming over there,
and they've had their butts kicked for 3 weeks straight. You know, they're not. There's not a big gain for them to fight anymore.
Mm-hmm. Dude. I don't bugle really much. I just got a metal one from Phelps that I'm learning how to use and stuff. But
how is that one? I haven't called through it.
It's really loud.
It's loud.
It's loud, and it
Jason
sounds
likes
good.
To call loud.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
yeah. It's really loud. Like I got desperate 3 nights ago, and I was like, I'm just gonna start bugling, make them think that there's a herd of elk up here, and come get a tasty calf up here, you know. So, but. No, it's really good, but yeah. I don't bugle. I think it's just more fun. Mm-hmm. And I understand some of the sounds, and if I dedicated more time to it, I obviously would, but I think all the elk I've killed, I mean, I've stopped them with a cow call, but everything's just been spot and stalk.
Mm.
So
trying to be sneakier than you were in
yeah.
sniper school.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, elk don't have two veteran trained scout sniper sitting on top of a 7-ton with binoculars looking down into a field where you're supposed to be sneaking around. And
yeah. Yeah. But they do have some 16-year-old ewe-necked cow doesn't have a tooth left in her face. That's just angry and paranoid.
Yes, that is true.
Yeah. They've got their own equivalent of spotters.
Yeah, they do.
Are you going to bear hunt this fall?
Yeah. Yeah, I've seen a couple of bears over there where I elk hunt down there south of town. And so,
you hear about the guy in Mount Emily got mauled?
Really?
This was yesterday. So the night before he shot the bear, was trying to get into his chicken coop just outside town in LeGrand.
Okay.
Shot it. Sounds like it was a 22-250, something like that. And, you know, we wasn't bear hunting. He had a bear trying to get after his livestock. Bear takes off. He goes to try and find it the next morning. And sounds like he shot it again and it mauled him. Pretty bad.
Wow.
Pretty bad. Got some photos of him. His arms are all tore up.
Mm-hmm.
His you know, got into his head a little bit.
Jeez.
But I'm trying to get him on the show. I want to hear his story.
Yeah. It'd be like a more recent version of Todd Orr. Well, I mean, we only got attacked once.
It's happening more and more. You know, I had Kevin Plew on the show last fall. He was guiding and had a bear come and knock him down, and he shot him with his, I think, a 40 all the way in, and mm-hmm. bear actually stood on top of him and ripped up his jacket, was drooling on him. Kevin had blood all over his jacket from the bear. Wow. And the bear stumbled off, and they never found it. Hmm. And that was just down here in the canyon.
Really?
But, you know, I posted it last week. It's like, fawns and calves are hitting the ground in the next 10 days. Bears are going to start eating meat and get aggressive. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, somebody, you know, got the bad end of that. But it's just happening more and more with black bears.
Yeah.
And I think that a lot of the pistol training that people are doing right now is this LARPer, John Wick, freaking nonsense, and it's driving me crazy. We need to, as outdoorsmen, get back to some more realistic scenarios for drawing and firing a handgun.
Mm-hmm.
and make sure that we're practicing that and using good ammunition and being diligent about keeping a handgun on us and being proficient with it. Because this is just happening a lot. Mm-hmm. It's happening every year, you know, more than once just in this area.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, yeah.
No, I...
Freaking bears.
Yeah. Well, last year when I was going to check cameras, because just for kicks and stuff,
yeah.
And it was like July 28th or something, and I was going down, and I just see this bear cruising, and I could have snuck up on it and stuff, and I was like... And I think I was on night shift at that point, so I just forgot what day it was and stuff like that. And I looked at my phone, because if it was August, I was going to buy a tag real quick and then go down there and shoot that thing. But no, there's a lot of bears in there.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of bears, a lot of elk, and like no deer. We saw this last year, and this Jeep drove by our camp, and like 45 minutes later, they come back, and they got this tiny little spike tongue hanging out in the back seat of the Jeep, and they're like, filter our deer tag, and I'm like, gosh dang it, dude.
Yeah. We needed to give that one a chance.
Yeah, like if it's like
we hadn't even bred a doe yet.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't buy cougar tags though, because I've never even seen one.
Mm.
I saw that you killed one recently.
Yeah. Yeah, I killed a great big one this year. You know, it's $16.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you're gonna see one at some point.
Maybe. But I mean, I always wonder how many have seen me.
Lots.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And in some of the areas that you hunt, you know, those are, you know, really high lion density areas. You know, some of them are like, I'll get the numbers wrong, so I'm not even going to say them. But some of the Blue Mountain areas have the highest lion densities in the country. And
really?
Total.
I thought Steens had the highest.
Not according to the charts that I've been seeing lately.
Hmm.
But again, a notoriously difficult animal to survey. They're using models, which, you know, have inherent inaccuracies, but they're doing the best that they can. If somebody came to me and was like, hey, I need you to count all the cougars in Oregon, I'd be like, oh my God, how do I even start? This is, you know, an impossible task. So you got to use models, but yeah. So you're in areas that have a lot of them, and since the season is open all year long,
mm-hmm.
just spend the $16, get your tag, and then if you have one that rolls up on you while you're cow calling, and it's a legit self-defense scenario, who cares? You just shoot and put your tag on it, mm-hmm. and then you don't have to go through the investigation and all the rigmarole.
That's
like
true.
Your $16 is very well spent at that point. Like that bear that I killed a couple years ago that charged me when I was blood trailing mm-hmm. the elk for that client. It was August. I had a bear tag. I just tagged it. Like mm-hmm. that was it. And you know, the question I got over and over again, it's like, wow, you shot a bear in self-defense. What happens now? Do they have to come in? No, I just tagged it.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you just get to treat it like a bear hunt or a lion hunt at that
yeah.
point. But
yeah.
Yeah. Just spend Do you need $16? I'll give you $16.
No. After you interviewed the guy, the Northeast Ungulate.
Oh, I haven't interviewed him yet. But
you haven't?
No, I need to.
Oh, man.
I got to get him over here because I don't want to do it on Zoom.
Yeah. He lives in the Dalles or something like that, doesn't he?
Hermiston.
Does he?
Yep.
Wow. Well, yeah, I follow some of his stuff, and that guy's got the cougar hunting down.
He's a killer. He's an interesting guy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. My neighbor down the road, he actually will go out for cougars in the winter and stuff, and he'll just look for a fresh track and go after it. And he's got dogs and stuff that he'll hunt bobcats with.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I've been trying to get him to take me and like show me what to do for cougars, because I'm like,
you know, that persistence thing. Mm-hmm. That's got to be the biggest part, right? Because it's not hard to go out and find a lion track. Like, mm-hmm. you know, it snows, give it 6 hours, go start driving roads. You're going to cut a lion.
Mm-hmm.
And then all you have to do is not give up.
Yeah.
Like, there's a lion attached to the end of that trail.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
But it might go for miles. He might go over the next ridge and kill a deer and be right there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That would be cool.
It is the toughest hunt in the country.
Oh, yeah.
The lowest odds, and so available. So available. It's year-round. Two tags apiece. $16 for non-residents. $16 for residents.
Mm-hmm.
Like, this is the hunt people should be doing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and all the guys that are like, well, I hunt bighorn sheep for the challenge. Like, shut up.
Mm-hmm.
No, you do not. You can find every aspect of challenge from any hunt in a mountain lion hunt, and you mm-hmm. can do it on the cheap all year round.
Yeah.
But people are starting to realize it, and I think, you know, me not shutting up about it is helping, but
yeah.
I'm hearing from people all over the country who are coming to Oregon now to hunt cougars because it's such a high adventure, you know, high reward hunt that doesn't cost that much money.
That's true.
Underrated.
Just not give up.
Not give up. Okay, last question.
Yeah.
What does Memorial Day mean to you? You know, you've had Marines killed next to you. You've been in combat. You know, what is the day? What does the weekend mean to you?
I think it means a lot of people put stuff out on social media and this and that, and I just take the time to reflect for myself
mm-hmm.
about those folks, and I do it. Some people post about Marines and stuff that were killed and like, hey, people remember this person and stuff, but for me, I take time to reflect on it by myself, because
mm-hmm.
I don't think I need to share that with really anybody,
right?
And I think some people turn it into a Veterans Day, and it's like, well, it's not Veterans Day.
Yeah.
And that's what a lot of people don't understand, is because on Memorial Day weekend and stuff, people will say, oh, thank you for your service, and it's like, it's not what it's about.
Yeah, this day isn't for me.
Yeah.
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 And I know where that's coming from for them. Like, mm-hmm. it's coming from a good place. And I know what they're saying, but it is something that comes up year after year. It's like, no, this is for the fallen. This is for mm-hmm. the lost.
Yeah.
And it's not just Afghanistan. It's not Iraq. It's not Syria. It's every war that we have fought as a country and the people that died to be able to make it all possible.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Just a lot of reflection for me.
Yeah. Cool. Well, I wish you all the best of luck this upcoming hunting season.
Yeah.
Yeah. If people want to follow along in your adventures, how do they do that?
Yeah, I guess I'll give it out. On Instagram, Wild at Heart, 233, something like that.
I think 2-3.
Yeah, 2-3.
Okay.
It's a blocked account, or it's a private account. Yeah. And so, but I'll assess each person.
Yeah.
If
we'll
somebody see, actually wants to follow
we'll see
what
if
I
you
do.
Make the grade. Yeah.
Yeah.
You can see some good techniques for deadlifting.
Yeah.
Maybe the occasional kettlebell swing.
Yeah. Yeah. I got a nice home gym there.
Heck yeah, you do.
Yeah. I built it built it when COVID happened and stuff, and then I just kept building it, and then my wife got a rower this last summer, and it's been taken off. So
when we still had a gym here back in the good old days, I really appreciated your help in, you know, giving me some advice and stuff on weightlifting, because it's not something that I know how to do. And a lot of people will see you post a video or whatever, and, you know, they just want to pick you apart. You were totally coming at that from a place of like, hey, I'm concerned about what your left knee is doing. And this is how you can fix it. And I really sincerely appreciated that. That was cool of you.
Cool. Yeah. And then you hooked up with Kyle Camp a little bit.
Yeah.
And he is like the nicest person on the planet.
I love Kyle.
He's such a great dude.
Yeah. Yeah.
I keep meaning to visit with him when I go over to Idaho area and stuff sometimes, but I never do. And
he comes back over here quite a bit. He's got family here.
Yeah. His wife's family's over there in Wallawa.
Yeah.
Yeah. So.
All right, brother. Well, I really appreciate your time.
Yeah.
Sorry you didn't come home with a bear this spring, but I'm glad you got out there.
Yeah. Thanks, man. I appreciate it.
Thank you all very much for listening. I'm going to keep bringing you these stories from normal people just like you who have done extraordinary things. Everyone is an expert at something, and they have interesting perspectives on life and work and the environment and all the things that we care about. I'm going to keep bringing that to you. And I want to thank you so much for making this show possible. I also want to thank Emily Bratcher for producing this show. She does a great job editing. Really appreciate her. I want to thank John Chatelain. He did the art for the Six Ranch podcast. And Celia, soon to be Harlander, she digitized that so that we can get it out there on the internet for you. Also want to thank Justin Hay for writing this original music and the beautiful whistling that you're listening to right now. You guys are awesome. Thank you so much. Please keep listening to the show. Write me a review if you feel like it, and just keep doing your thing, and we'll all learn from this together. It's been fun, and you know, we're just getting started.